Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage. Man lives in the sunlit world of what he believes to be reality. But there is, unseen by most, an underworld, a place that is just as real, but not as brightly lit. A dark side.
Hey, who turned off all the lights, projectionist?
Confound it all, Sage. You ruined my intro.
Intro? Hey, I can see the recording light is on. Did you send me down to the commissary just so you could record the new episode without me? Here's your cherry humps candy.
Why, thank you, Victor. The Shoeless Candy Factory never should have ceased producing these delicious treats.
Good Lord, projectionist. Please, put your cowl on while you're eating. Just be glad the retros can somehow stock this place with such forgotten treats. I've said it before. I don't know how he does it, but I'm glad I can just jaunt down to level 4 of the vault and eat lunch at the Burger Chef.
Indeed.
Now then, why did you start the recording early?
I have grown tired of allowing you to always choose the subjects of our radio program.
Projectionist, if you wanted to choose a subject, you should have just asked me, my friend. I thought, though, we were going to be discussing The Twilight Zone's The Howling Man. You seemed to really enjoy it when we screened it last week.
I most certainly did enjoy The Howling Man. However, the other evening, I took pity on intern Rockford J.
That would be a first.
What was that?
Nothing. Just clearing my throat.
He mentioned he was rather fond of an anthology television series entitled Tales from the Dark Side.
Oh, yeah. I've had a few conversations with him myself about that series, too. And it's not like we haven't covered a few episodes of the show on this podcast.
Rockford J shared with me an episode called The Odds.
That's a great one, projectionist.
So you are familiar with it, then?
Absolutely. It's from the first season of Tales from the Dark Side, episode 5, if I remember correctly. It has a remarkable cast, to say the least. The great Danny Aiello, character actor Robert Weil, and, of course, the exceptional Tom Noonan. You okay, projectionist?
Go ahead and do one of your world-famous and drawn-out synopsis.
You can do it if you want, my—
Just get on with your over-bloated explanations, Victor.
All right. I guess we should warn the listeners that we will be doing a full synopsis. So, spoilers ahead.
Just get on with it.
Okay, calm down. This episode of Tales from the Dark Side originally aired on October 21st, 1984. A perfect choice to help people tuning in to get into the Halloween spirit. It was co-written and directed by James Stephen Sadwith from a story by Carol Lucia Satrina. We will touch on their careers after this episode's synopsis. The Odds concerns Tommy Vale, played by Danny Aiello, an aging bookie who, for 31 years, has made Phil's Bar his place of operation. Throughout time.
Now then, how do you know that the establishment is known as Phil's Bar?
Because the bartender is named Phil, projectionist. played by Anthony Bishop. Plus, you can see the window sign behind Tommy throughout this episode.
I must have missed that while watching it. Please continue.
Anyway, as I was saying, throughout Tommy's career, he has had his good friend, Horace Chadway, by his side, who is played by Robert Weil. Tommy perhaps is a little gruff, but seems to be an honorable character, wouldn't you say?
For a numbers runner, certainly. Although, in his favor, he does have an understandable distaste for modern gadgets, such as the musical pocket calculator that Horace Chadway plays with.
Tommy is definitely old school. He doesn't even trust something as simple as a pocket calculator. Instead, he prefers to do the math in his head. He seems to take pride in it as well. I think we should point out the chemistry between Tommy and Horace. Aiello and Robert work really well together. Without having been told, you know there is a great deal of history between these two. They stuck by each other through thick and thin. More brothers than friends.
Perhaps. However, Horace is certainly the lackey, showing deference towards Tommy Vale.
Yeah, that's true, but I think lackey is too strong of a word. I say there is a strong emotional bond between the two that goes beyond just being co-workers for over three decades. It certainly looks like Phil's bar, while quaint, has some issues with the heat. All three men in the bar, Tommy, Horace, and Phil, are sweating.
Might that have something to do with what appears to be the lack of business, as it were?
True. Horace mentions it's been 3 days since anyone has placed a bet. While I know nothing of being a bookie, I do know there's always some kind of sports event taking place, so that does seem rather odd.
Do you know anything about sports either, Victor?
You kidding me? Why do you think I work down here in the Retroist Vault? Tommy makes a point that even with a lack of business, he has always paid his own debts and never been cheated. He considers himself the best.
Oh my. Tommy Vale's faith in that statement is about to be tested.
Absolutely, projectionist. It's hot enough in Phil's bar that Tommy asks Horace to grab him a beer. His friend is gone for a few seconds when Tommy visibly shudders, calling out to Phil that something must be wrong with the fans in the bar. He's actually getting a chill.
Director James Stephen Sadwith wisely shows both Phil and Horace Chadway sweating and taking a moment to look up. None of the fans in the speakeasy are in operation. This cold, dear listeners, is from something supernatural.
That is exactly the case. As, unseen by anyone, there is now a stranger standing in the bar. A tall and lanky man dressed in a spotless white suit and wearing a Panama hat. A man by the name of Lacey, who is played by Tom Noonan. Silently, this new arrival walks by Horace and Phil and takes a seat opposite of Tommy. The man also sports a giant grin on his face, smiling like the cat that ate the canary.
That smile is held uncomfortably long, dear listeners. So much so that Tommy Vale inquires if someone is tickling Lacey's leg to cause that smile.
It's a great line to be sure, and much like with Robert Weil, Aiello and Noonan play off each other brilliantly. Now, Lacey, although we do not know his name just yet, really is odd. He acts almost like he's a sleepwalker. After Tommy's comment concerning why he's just sitting there smiling, Lacey starts to search in the pockets of his suit before pulling out a piece of paper. We don't see what's on it, but the stranger silently reads it to himself, like he's remembering his lines. It turns out he is here to place a bet.
The strangeness of Lacey continues, not only with his jovial demeanor, but with what he places on the table in front of Tommy Vale. 5 coins. Lacey assures the bookie that they are uncirculated nickels, worth $500.
Tommy, I feel it's safe to say, is getting some bad vibes off the man in front of him. He warns Lacey, though, that the bet is steep. The horse the stranger favors has 40-1 odds. Tommy slides the coins back to Lacey, but then the grinning man takes a different approach.
Too high for you, Tommy? Tommy Vale?
Too high? That phrase ain't in my dictionary. Try too late. First time a Belmont's a two. Philly, turn on the race. Let's hear what Mr. Sunshine missed.
We'll begin at the starting gate for the first race here. We've had a slight delay for the opener on this sweltering Saturday afternoon at Belmont Park. The flag is up, and they're on.
That delay in the start of the races gives Lacey enough time to slide the coins back as they listen to the event on the radio, which Tommy this time accepts with a rueful nod. Wherever Lacey comes from, he knows how the bookie thinks. That delay in the horse race giving Tommy just enough doubt in his mind that he can easily snag Lacey's $500. After all, the horse, Ryan's daughter, is a long shot to say the least.
Would you be willing to bet, dear listeners, on how the race turns out?
Horace and Tommy both are more than confident on their easy victory. In fact, Horace starts to play Chopin's Funeral March on his pocket calculator. Lacey doesn't seem to be affected by this, and just a couple of seconds later, the stranger has spun his $500 investment into $20,000. Tommy obviously isn't happy about this, but he is a man of his word. Not to mention, it seems that the heat has returned, judging by how much Tommy is now sweating. He tells Lacey to return the next day for his winnings.
Lacey wishes to take those fresh earnings and lay another wager.
Exactly, projectionist. He informs Tommy that the only bets he enjoys are those that have big payoffs. So Lacey puts his $20,000 on the Orioles at 3-1 odds. Horace is quick to remind his boss and friend that a bet of that size, if Lacey wins, is, well, dangerous.
Ooh, Tommy Vale, however, reminds both men he has never, ever refused a bet. It's not in his code of conduct as a successful numbers runner.
While 3 days previously, the phones at Phil's bar were dead, in the very next scene, we see them ringing off the hook. Horace is kept busy writing down wagers from all over the city. The table at the booth Tommy is sitting at is covered with scraps of paper, all of them marks he has accepted.
All of those scraps of papers, with bets as you can already guess, on the Orioles to win.
Horace isn't the only one noticing that someone is spreading hunches to gamblers across the city, and in this case, costing Tommy a whole lot of money. Obviously, that someone is Lacey, who appears out of nowhere yet again, in a stellar mood at his good fortune. I know I keep driving this home, but it is important. Tommy is an honorable man, although he is definitely sizing up the stranger now as he slides a box filled with $60,000 to Lacey. Tommy can't help but address the issue as he does so, and we learn a little something about Lacey. We start to see why he has decided to frequent Phil's bar and chip away at Tommy Vale.
You always share your hunches with the general public?
Well, I like to spread the good word. I like to make people happy. I see happy people.
I'm happy.
Son of a gun. Horace, get over here.
Yo! Well, if it ain't the walking public service message.
Horace, Mr. Sunshine here. He remind you of someone?
I've been thinking he looks real familiar, but I can't place the face.
Horace, try way, way back.
Maybe you remember Bill Lacey?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So you're Bill Lacey's kid, huh?
Nice box. I like the box. I like boxing. I like Jorge Ramirez tonight at the Garden.
Ramirez, he's an 8-1 shot.
Ramirez, the bold avenger. Very apropos. You trying to put me out of business, kid?
Just like that, friends, Tommy is finding himself having to defend his reputation again of never refusing a bet. He keeps lowering the odds in hopes he will drive Lacey off. The boxing match odds he offers to the young man is 8-1. If Lacey wins, and deep down we viewers realize that the bookie is beginning to question if the stranger will ever lose, it will earn the young man a whopping $240,000.
As Victor has already mentioned, Tommy Vale has been a very successful bookie. Played the odds in his favor as to be able to survive the occasional losses. This is another matter entirely.
You're totally right, projectionist. $240,000 is too much, even for Tommy, which is why he excuses himself to make a phone call to those of higher power than himself, who trust Tommy's work and will help him cover the bet if he loses.
Why, Sage? You are, of course, referring to the Mafia, eh?
Indeed. This gives us time for a very nice scene between Horace and Lacey. We not only learn that Lacey's father, Bill, is indeed deceased, if we had any questions about that, but that the young man holds Tommy Vale responsible for the fact. Horace is quick to mention that while Bill may have been very unlucky in his gambling, he was always a nice guy. Something, he adds, that Lacey seems to be lacking.
Tommy Vale returns in time from his phone conversation to overhear Lacey's remark that he feels it should be himself and not his father that were dead.
The aging bookie has been calm, if maybe a little cagey, up to this point. But now, Tommy explosively lays down some facts. He never pushes anyone into a bet, and he never forced the late Bill Lacey into making wagers he couldn't afford. I got the idea that maybe he tried talking the man out of making such bad bets, actually. Most important of all, though, we learn that Bill Lacey jumped off a bridge to avoid those very debts, an act that Tommy doesn't feel he was responsible for. What he will accept, however, is Lacey's boxing wager. Tommy's really gotten under the young man's skin with his outburst. This is the first time we've seen Lacey get bent out of shape, too. Be anything beyond smiling or strangely devoid of emotion. The young man bolts up from the table and hurriedly leaves, remarking that the bookie better have his money the following day. To which the bookie replies, "If you win."
Naturally, the next day finds Bill Lacey's son $240,000 richer. The younger Lacey is ready to place yet another bet. This one most curious and out of the ordinary indeed.
That is an understatement, projectionist. Lacey is willing now to bet his $240,000 on even odds. The wager? By 8 a.m. the following day, Tommy will be dead. Now, like we previously mentioned, Lacey is on fire with his hunches. Would you be willing to play those odds, listeners?
Hey, this is Tommy Vale, legendarily known to never back down from a wager, correct? So, of course he accepts that bet. Much to the horror of Horace Chadway. The rules are hastily laid down. Lacey is to return to Fields Bar that very evening, where all three men will stay the night to see who is the big winner when 8 o'clock in the morning arrives.
True. But it looks like the Mafia has sent a man to ensure their money is being well looked after. I suppose, even with Tommy's reputation, the mob isn't taking any chances with that amount of money.
Lacey brings his own backup as well. At his side is a pale and emotionless soul, a gangster of old, if there ever was one. He stands stationary next to the money as Lacey settles in at the booth, once again opposite of Tommy.
I think there's something we should mention to the listeners, projectionist.
And what might that be, Sage?
After the second bet goes horribly wrong for Tommy, so much money going out to cover the wagers, he actually has Horace teach him how to use that pocket calculator. I guess it's just too much moolah for even Tommy to keep straight in his head.
Or perhaps he enjoys using it as a clock. Does it not chime at the strike of every hour?
That's quite true. Although, it still seems to annoy the bookie something fierce. Lacey has regained his composure from the previous evening, with Tommy and Horace sweating again, perhaps even more so than usual. But the bookie, to his friend's dismay, makes a point to show how unaffected he is by this strange ordeal. He does his best to get some shut-eye. After all, why not rest when you can? As the night passes, Tommy awakes and slowly opens his eyes to continuously see Lacey staring at him, dispassionately. Then, at around 7:55 in the morning, it appears that Lacey has won his wager after all. The bookie is still as the grave. Horace, in obvious distress, shakes his friend, calling his name.
Which is when Tommy Vale bursts out laughing at his gallows humor. Dear listeners, this also is when the number runner reveals a secret of his own. He has always known who Lacey was.
You're still smiling. You must know something I don't.
I know it's 7:55. And I still got 5 minutes.
That ain't much. You should be sweating by now.
5 minutes? I don't sweat the small stuff.
Oh, you used to. You used to sweat the small stuff. And you choked on the big stuff. And now you're going to choke again when I don't die by 8. You think I don't know who you are, how you got here, and how come you're so hot? I knew you as soon as you walked in here, Bill Lacey.
Lacey's dead. I went to his funeral.
Well, that may be. But he's sitting right there, and he's still a cheap little coward. Still pulling cheap tricks, trying to cheat me, trying to break me, trying to be the big shot. Well, sure, he found out from the other side when I was going to croak, and he took that inside dope and tried to make it pay.
Now, you notice that Tommy grudgingly admitted that Bill Lacey, in his attempt at supernatural vengeance, did find out when he was supposed to die. But he adds that Bill didn't count on the strength of willpower. Tommy remarks that Bill never had willpower in life or in death, and that is why he will lose this wager.
The clock strikes 8 o'clock, the pocket calculator chiming the time as well. And Tommy Vale is still alive.
The mafioso wastes no time in snatching up both cases of money and beats feet out of the bar. Not only has Bill Lacey lost his bet, but in doing so, Tommy's profits have wiped clean his own debts. Now, I've mentioned how when watching the odds that I get the idea that Tommy is an honorable man. However, he begins to really belittle Bill Lacey at this point. I guess if I'm being honest, it's not like Lacey doesn't deserve it, right?
Oh, indeed. Tom Noonan does something remarkable during the scene, dear listeners. His joyousness evaporates before our very eyes. He takes on the form of a man who realizes he must always be a loser. He isn't angry. His body language is that of acceptance as he and his own ghostly mafia backup leave the table and vanish before they reach the door to the speakeasy. No reason for subterfuge now, eh?
Exactly, projectionist. Think about it for a second. Bill Lacey was totally cheating by using supernatural knowledge to first wipe out not just Tommy's fortune, but what he spent a lifetime building up, his reputation, and the fact he could be present to gloat when the man died.
Many people discount the willpower to survive, Victor. Trust me, I know.
Oh, I'm sure you do, my friend. However, after Lacey's departure, Tommy is really overcome with his own feelings of joy. laughing at what he just went through. Taking bets and defeating the plans of a ghost, after all, should make one feel a bit happier, right? It goes beyond that, though, friends. As the odds begins to wind down, we learn that Tommy, yet again an honorable man, cheated a little himself. He set the clock in Phil's bar, and even on that pocket calculator, an hour ahead.
Yes, Tommy Vail, in the end, cheated the cheater.
Absolutely, projectionist. Both Tommy and Horace can't help but laugh over Lacey falling for what the bookie calls the oldest trick in the book. In fact, Tommy asks his friend to get him a beer, as he feels it's too hot within the bar. Obviously, Horace is glad to, leaving Tommy to chuckle at his own fortune. Tommy Vail remains unbroken, as well as true to his word, of never refusing a bet or being cheated. Although, you'll recall, listeners, that Tommy did admit to Lacey he knew the time of his death. And in the end, Tommy pays his own dues to the dark side, passing away as the clock truly strikes 8 a.m. At the least, though, we can see the bookie has died content. And that, friends, is the synopsis for The Odds. Definitely one of the shining examples of great storytelling and acting from the Tales from the Dark Side series.
The only point of contention I've had with The Odds, Sage, is I wish they had spent more money on the episode itself. While it is indeed intended and shot to be claustrophobic, it feels a little cheaply made.
Well, projectionist, remember that this was a syndicated series, so they didn't have a huge budget by any means. Then, throw in talent like Aiello and Noonan, I'm sure they worked for scale on this episode, which should tell you how much they loved the script. Friends, The Odds has a real strong Twilight Zone vibe. A lot of the Tales from the Dark Side episodes focused on monsters and such. This is just a simple one-room affair. The actors really making that script sizzle. Honestly, in the first season of Tales from the Dark Side, you have some real winners, with the first episode, Trick or Treat, which was written by co-producer George A. Romero. You also have Inside the Closet, which was directed by Tom Savini. Then, The Word Processor of the Gods, an adaptation of the Stephen King short story of the same name. Just to name a few standout episodes in the 23-episode run marking the first season.
I believe I once heard that both Tom Savini and the late and great George A. Romero considered the Tales from the Dark Side series to be the successor to the Creepshow films.
You're partially right, my friend. Tom Savini has gone on record saying 1990's Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, is, in his mind, what Creepshow 3 would have been. Although, it's been said that the TV series came about because George A. Romero and fellow executive producers Richard P. Rubenstein and Jerry Gollad wanted to make a Creepshow television series.
Is that so?
It certainly is. The problem is, Warner Brothers owned some of the rights to Creepshow, so they decided to keep with certain aspects of that movie. The spirit of those classic EC comics, of course. So Creepshow the series became Tales from the Dark Side.
The title echoing the likes of EC Comics' Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horrors, eh?
Absolutely, projectionist. That little bit of narration you were doing when I first walked in was scripted by George A. Romero, actually.
Such a legendary director narrated the opening?
No, not at all. That honor goes to Paul Sperrer, of Spencer for Hire and Another World fame. Although, what I heard when walking in, you did a fair job of it yourself, my friend.
Why, thank you, Victor. Say, what do you mean, fair?
I mean, it's time to possibly change gears and see if you have anything to share with the listeners. Did you thread some vintage movie trailers?
Naturally. In fact, dear listeners, I have chosen a handful of horror-related treats featuring our leads from The Odds.
Hey,
Well, we have minimal power. The recording light is still on, at least.
Projectionist? Vic, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Rockford. We've lost power through the upper levels of the vault.
Yeah, I might have had something to do with that. I was just switching on that new generator for you, Projectionist.
Oh, very good. Intern Rockford J. Is it operational?
Sort of. It's secreting some kind of ooze, maybe ichor. It smells really bad. Glows in the dark, too.
That doesn't sound good.
Intern Rockford J, is it indeed ooze or ichor?
I dipped my spanner in it and it dissolved.
Ichor.
It might be wise for you to shut the generator down for the time being.
Can do.
Thanks, Rockford. You be careful down there.
No worries. Projectionist, it kind of sounds like the generator is breathing.
Oh, do not pay that any mind. No equipment such as that generator needs time to become acclimated to its new surroundings. Best, though, you shut it down quickly.
Will do. Vic, I'll see you for the screening of Dracula AD 1972 later tonight. I hope.
Intern Rockford J will be fine. I am sure of it. On the other hand, there's always more interns, eh?
Oh, Projectionist, Human Resources isn't gonna like that.
Jacob Singer is afraid. When he walks down the street, people are watching. When he comes home at night, people are waiting. Jacob Singer is running out of time. This fall, Adrian Lyne, the director of Fatal Attraction, brings us a disturbing new vision. Jacob's Ladder.
At 8, 7 Central.
Is it an animal?
If you have a taste for terror,
something out there might be eating people.
Be sure to catch Wolfen. Parental discretion advised. Thursday.
I can see by the clock here in the control room, assuming the projectionist didn't set it ahead, shows we've crossed over the 30-minute mark. So, I will make this short. The director of The Odds, James Stephen Sadwith, would go on to direct another Tales from the Dark Side episode, another good one, this time from Season 2, entitled Monsters in My Room. He would also direct both the 1992 Sinatra and 2005 Elvis miniseries. I suppose he enjoys some classic music. In 1997, he created, co-produced, co-wrote, and directed an episode of Gun. Co-writer for this episode, Carol Lucia Citrina, would provide the story for the Tales from the Dark Side episode, In the Cards, as well as write the episode, Parlor Floor Front, in 1985. She would also write the screenplay for 1987's live-action, Beauty and the Beast, starring Rebecca De Mornay and John Savage. And then, a year later, she would write both Red Riding Hood and Puss in Boots. It seems that after that, she decided to leave show business behind. Danny Aiello has 101 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in films and television such as 1987's Moonstruck with Cher and Nicolas Cage, 1989's Do the Right Thing with Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, John Turturro, and of course, Spike Lee. He was also in 1990's Jacob's Ladder with Tim Robbins, as well as 1994's Leon the Professional, with Jean Reno, Natalie Portman, and a truly terrifying Gary Oldman. Tom Noonan has earned 82 acting credits, with notable roles in 1980's Heaven's Gate, 1981's Woofen, which I will admit I did not know until the projectionist shared that TV ad just a few seconds ago, 1985's The Man with One Red Shoe, 1986's Manhunter, the film that gave us our first taste of Hannibal Lecter, played by Brian Cox, 1987's Monster Squad, where he of course portrayed Frankenstein's monster, RoboCop 2 as the villainous Kane, 1995's Heat, and just recently, reoccurring roles in both AMC's Hell on Wheels and Sci-Fi's 12 Monkeys. Robert Weil had 37 acting credits to his name when he passed away in 2002, with notable roles in 1981's The Fan with Lauren Bacall, James Garner, and Michael Biehn. Robert was also featured in 1987's Moonstruck and had a role in the often overlooked comedy The Dream Team from 1989. One of his last roles was in the 1994 Coen Brothers comedy, The Hudsucker Proxy.
That was short.
I can't help it, my friend. I love sharing important roles that I think the listeners should seek out. I guess that wraps up this episode, though. Friends, on behalf of the projectionist and myself, thank you for taking the time to listen to us chat about the odds. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retroist.com. My co-host, the esteemed projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He generally shares old movie posters and newspaper advertisements a couple times a week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. Our newest intern is Rockford J. Not only can you find him every day sharing his own love of retro horror on the Saturday Frights Facebook page, but you can also totally find him on Facebook. We are so glad he decided to join the Saturday Frights team. We hope he survives it. As for myself, while I am still semi-retired from writing and podcasting, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist and Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So when you need your daily retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit The Retroist. Thank you again, friends. If you like the show, consider giving us a rating over on iTunes to help spread the word. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
You've come. Good.
What do you want me to do?
Lift off the wooden bolt.
Is this all that holds you in?
Yes, lift it off.
Well, why haven't you done it yourself?
Please, there's no time for talk.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well and goodbye.